the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
Let's read from the Bible, shall we? It's only a short passage, but if you'd like to get the green Bible from in front of you just to make sure I'm not making up, then please do. It's page 916, Matthew chapter 5, and we're going to read again the very few verses that we're focusing on microscopically for about 8 weeks. So that's Matthew chapter 5, page 916, and we're going to start to read from verse 13. This is part of the Sermon on the Mount, the most sort of profound and connected sermon that we've got of Jesus, and something that's been an inspiration, obviously, for hundreds and hundreds of years, packed with meaning, and so we need to look at it pretty closely, as we are doing. So, verse 13, "You are the salt of the earth," says Jesus. "But if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It's no longer good for anything, except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot. You are the light of the world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven." Well, new president in America, and this guy has gone. Here's Barack Obama leaving the Oval Office for the last time. Shortly after that, he and his family boarded a chopper, and they were leaving Washington very quickly. What's he going to do next? What do you do when you've been so important and suddenly all of your importance is taken away from you? You've been something, and all of a sudden, you're nothing very much. Well, John Quincy Adams, who was president back in the 19th century, said this: "There is nothing more pathetic in life than a former president." What do you actually do with your time? And if you look back at the last few presidents, you'll find they've done all kinds of different things. Gerald Ford spent most of his time after presidency playing golf. George W. Bush took up painting, and he was much better at it than people expected, because some quite surprising work. Ronald Reagan, he was the oldest one to retire, and he was already pretty ill, and he went into Alzheimer's pretty quickly after he left the presidency. Within a year, he was very, very different from what he had been in his last days in power. Jimmy Carter, very strongly Christian president who really wanted to do good, joined Habitat for Humanity and went around the world building houses for the poor. And then there's Richard Nixon, who left in some disarray, let's say, and for a while after that he was battling illness brought on by the stress of Watergate and all the rest of it. Massive debts to pay. He had to sell all his houses in Florida and try to make the books balance, so he was pretty busy. But all of the former presidents have found something to do. It's just not been on the same level of importance. How about Obama? He's pretty young. Is he going to ever go into a political job again? Well, no, it doesn't look like it. One of his advisors says that he's just going to be a normal, ordinary citizen. And he himself has said that it's fair to say that this is going to be his last campaign. He's not going to seek another elected office. And in fact, that's probably not just his decision, because a few weeks ago, when he was being asked by an interviewer, "Would you like to continue in politics, Mr. President?" Michelle broke in and said, "No, that's a no." So she's got pretty clear ideas. In fact, the Obamas have been thinking about it, and it's a shame. I don't know if we can get the sound on this, but for the White House Correspondents' Dinner last year, just before it all came to an end for him, he made a little video. I can't think of many former presidents that would be this funny, actually, but he made a video just imagining what it would be like if he reached the end of the road, and his advisor was saying to him, "Well, you know, you'll have to get a proper driving license again. You haven't needed one. And what will you do? You can always go and play basketball." So here he is phoning up his daughter's, phoning up the local Washington basketball team and saying, "I've actually coached my daughter's team, you know," and the line goes dead. "Hello? Hello, hello, who's there?" Then he goes to the Department of Motor Vehicles to get his license back and finds this very suspicious lady who says, "Your name is what? Barack Hussein Obama? Have you got a birth certificate?" And he produces a piece of paper from his pocket, and hands it over to her, and she looks at it about as suspiciously as Donald Trump might have done, and he says, "It's a real birth certificate," and she says, "Is it really?" As I say, not many presidents have that sense of humour, but obviously he's been thinking a bit about it. But it's something, isn't it? When you're something one minute and you're nothing straight after, when it all comes down to nothing, what's left behind? Well, that's kind of where we've got to in this series we're doing. We're talking about these verses that we've read this morning, and over the next few weeks, we're talking about what it means to be the salt of the earth and the light of the world. And we started out 2 weeks ago just looking at these six Greek words that starts it off. You are the salt of the earth. And we were saying that salt did all kinds of different things in the ancient world. It was all around in Israel. If you go down to the southeast of the country, you'll find Mount Sodom, massive mountain, which is 80% salt. It's unbelievable. In most parts of the world, something like that just wouldn't last. It wouldn't survive. But it's there, and more than that, it's 8 miles long, and it's rising by 3.5 millimeters every year. How is it getting higher? Well, simply because it's a mixture of salt and rock and earth and stuff like that, and the rock and the earth is heavier than the salt. So it's pushing down and forcing the salt up. So every year, the salt rises just a little bit higher. And you are the salt of the earth suggests all kinds of different things. There are all sorts of different purposes that salt was good for. And we said 2 weeks ago, probably the main one in Jesus' mind here, of all of them, was the idea that salt is fertilizer. And so the followers of Jesus are supposed to be people who fertilize society, who get out there, get mixed up with people, the salt of the earth, go into the soil and change it, make things crop up and happen that wouldn't be happening otherwise, encourage growth, encourage nutrition, encourage enrichment. That's what it's all about. And the salt of the earth is what Christians are supposed to be. Just as those rocks of salt tower over Mount Sodom and all sorts of fancy shapes, Christians are supposed to be different from the rest of society. And last week, Derek took on the next bit of the verse, which says, if, however, the salt loses its saltiness, with what will it be salted? If salt ceases to be salt, if it doesn't have the flavor, if it doesn't have the tang any longer, what good actually is it? And Derek made 3 points about it. The first one was that salt actually doesn't lose its saltiness. Salt is one of the most stable things you can find. And so what Jesus is talking about a ridiculous situation here in some ways. And by the way, the Bible is not wrong. You sometimes find on those kind of pole-faced, humorless, skeptic lists of contradictions in the Bible on the internet. Jesus says that salt loses its saltiness. It doesn't actually. Scientists can tell you that. Just shows how wrong the Bible actually is. Well, it just shows how little Greek they know, actually, because what that word actually says, it loses its saltiness. What it really means is, if, however, the salt becomes silly... Because that's what the word actually means. It's the same word that's used in the book of Romans, where there's a verse about people who turn away from God and professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. It's the same word, more something. It's the word from which we get moron. So if the salt becomes moronic, that's all it says. It becomes silly, it becomes foolish, it doesn't do the job it's supposed to do. With what shall it be salted? So Derek said, salt doesn't lose its saltiness. And when you become a Christian, God puts something in your life that you cannot lose very quickly. It's not up to you to keep it going. It's up to his power, his grace, his supply of your resources. But salt can be diluted and weak. Just like the salt of Mount Sodom, mixed up with earth and rock and all sorts of stuff, it can become dilute with all kinds of other stuff, and then it won't have the same effect. It will be as if it's lost its salty power. And it's possible for Christians to do that, to get so close to the world that they start looking just like everybody else. Salt makes a difference because it is different. And if you lose that difference, then you're going nowhere. And the third point Derek made was that salt mustn't stay in the salt cellar. It has to get spread out if it's going to do any use. There was a merchant of Sodom once who persuaded the city fathers, Sidon, in the north, not in the south, and he persuaded the city fathers to let him have all of the income from salt in the neighborhood. And as a result, he bought up all the salt and stored it in his house. And they found after a year that the stuff that was at the top of the pile was good. But there were tons of it down towards the ground, which had become contaminated, and all he could do was shovel it out into the street and get rid of it because it was not salty any longer. So salt doesn't stay in the salt cellar. It gets out there, and you and I will be in different places this week, and wherever we are, if we're Christians, if we're followers of Jesus, we're supposed to be salt in that environment. Now, that raises two questions that we've got 10 minutes to answer this morning. First, what happens to Christians who lose their saltiness? Derek said it was a possibility last week. It can become diluted, it can become ineffective. But this verse goes on to say, so if that happens, it's good for nothing except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot. What does that actually mean? And the second question is, well, suppose you're not a Christian. Suppose, like the people that Derek was talking about a minute ago, you're just exploring, you're not sure what goes on. If you never had any saltiness in the first place, what difference would it make if you started being a follower of Jesus and you became part of the salt of the earth? Well, let's have a look at that. I don't know if you remember this guy's picture. He's been in the news again this week. This is Paul Flowers, who was once the chair of the Cooperative Bank. He thought he had $3 billion in assets, and actually it was $47 billion. He wasn't a very good bank chairman, and you might remember that he lost his job. He's been a Methodist minister for 40 years, and I think at one stage he definitely was following Jesus. But the story that came out was an incredible story about buying drugs. That's why they call him the Crystal Methodist. About rent boys, about all sorts of crooked schemes. And he's in the news this week because the Methodist Church have finally revoked his ministership. He's not allowed to call himself Reverend anything anymore. And also he, on the same day, put a picture on social media of himself naked to the waist with his latest toy boy. So he's come a long, long way from being a standard Christian. And you could say there's possibly one example of somebody who may have been going for it at one stage and then lost his saltiness. So what happens to Christians who lose their saltiness? Maybe not as powerfully as that, maybe not as spectacularly, as stridently as that, but nonetheless are losing their edge. Well, I think there are three things. First, they live a life that brings no results. Second, they live a life that finds no rest. And third, they live a life that wins no respect. Let's just look at those three things. First of all, they live a life that brings no results. One of the famous Latin proverbs recorded for us by Pliny the Elder, who was born just within the lifetime of Jesus, was nil utilio soli et sali. And you'd have heard Roman soldiers saying that all over Palestine in Jesus' day. What it means is, there is nothing more useful in life than sunshine and salt. Two things you can rely on, sunshine and salt. Nothing more useful, utilius. Because salt is useful for all kinds of purposes, just like sunshine is. It's nice to have some back this morning. It makes quite a difference, doesn't it? Salt and sunshine, salt and light, they make a tremendous difference in life. But if the salt loses its saltiness, what happens? Well, the next words in our verse say this: for nothing at all is it potent still. It's good for nothing. And that word good means potent, powerful. And the word that there describes, quoting from the lexicon, embodied strength that faces resistance and wins through successfully. So Jesus isn't just saying to people who've lost their saltiness, you're good for nothing. You're a waste of space. Get out of here. He's saying, no, what a waste. You're powerful for nothing. You're ineffective. You're not proving anything to anybody. And it's possible, sadly, for a Christian to lose all of his or her effect. Their ability to change the life, to change the world, to do good to other people's lives, just because the saltiness goes. A life that brings no results, that's maybe faithfully attending church week by week, that's doing all the right things and saying all the right things, but has no cutting edge whatsoever. And it's a life that finds no rest, because Jesus says, if not being thrown outdoors. That's the next bit. It's good for nothing except to be chucked out. And the word thrown out means being thrown outdoors. Kind of thing you do when, you know, you're sitting in the front room, you're watching your favorite television program, and suddenly, from under the sofa, out comes a massive spider and crawls over your foot. And you go, ah! And you get a newspaper and you persuade, come on, spider, nice spider. You get the newspaper on, the spider onto the newspaper, you go to the front door, you open, you go, yeah! And throw him out into the bushes. That's the kind of picture that's used. Thrown out. Just not wanted anymore. You're no good. You've got no power. And so there's no place for you. There's no rest for you. You have to go because there's nowhere there for you to be. Now, does that mean that if you lose your saltiness, Jesus will throw you out? No, I don't think so. Because Jesus says, my sheep are mine, and nobody's going to take them out of my hand. Once you become a Christian, you're safe. But you've lost your effectiveness, and you're no good any longer. I reckon most of us have got objects sitting in our kitchen cupboards that should be thrown out and haven't been. Oh yeah, people looking guilty down there. Because there's a lot of stuff, isn't there, that loses its edge, that goes past its sell-by date, and for some reason, well, it's not exactly green and moldy and, you know, and spiders crawling in and out of it, so we'll leave it there on the shelf, but it's never going to be any good any longer. And I believe that you can still be a Christian, but be ineffective and have no place of rest, no real place in Jesus' planning or purposes, because that's the way you are. John 6:37 is a place where Jesus said, I will never turn away anyone who comes to me. And I was quite excited preparing for this week to see that in that verse, Jesus uses exactly the same Greek words that he uses in Matthew chapter 5. I will never pick out and throw outdoors anyone who comes to me. I'll never reach the point where I say, right, I've had enough of you, away you go. And so, as Derek was saying last week, it doesn't depend on us, it depends on him. We can find our place of rest in following Jesus. But if you cease to be salty, there's no place of rest any longer. A life that brings no results, finds no rest, doesn't really belong in one world or the other, and a life that wins no respect. But to be trodden underfoot of men, if not being thrown outdoors, to be trampled upon by humans. Trampled upon by humans. What does that mean? Well, being trampled on means that they don't really notice you. You're not really making much difference, and so you're insignificant. You have no real place of value any longer. People don't value what you've got to offer. William Barclay, the Bible commentator, talking about this verse, said that the tragedy is that Christians have sometimes come across to people as people who don't really look the way they're supposed to. People have connected Christianity with that which takes the flavour out of life. And Algernon Swinburne, the 19th century poet, who was a bit of a strange man, but very, very anti-Christian, wrote in one of his poems, The Hymn to Proserpine, Thou hast conquered, O pale Galilean. The world has grown grey from thy breath. Christians are boring. Christians make no difference. Christians take all the joy out of life. And Barclay went on to talk about two more people. The American judge Oliver Wendell Holmes once said, I might have entered the ministry if certain clergymen I knew had not looked and acted so much like undertakers. Robert Louis Stevenson, great Scottish novelist. In fact, one of the greatest novelists. No, we won't do that. But Robert Louis Stevenson once entered in his diary, as if he was recording an extraordinary phenomenon, I have been to church today and I'm not depressed. And Barclay says, we need to discover the lost radiance of the Christian faith. In a worried world, Christians should be the only people who remain serene. In a depressed world, Christians should be the only people who remain full of the joy of life. There should be a sheer sparkle about Christians. Sometimes you catch it, don't you? When people are living salty lives, when people have really discovered what it's all about and taken it to heart and they're living that way, you can see in them something you can never see anywhere else. And so that takes us on to the second question before we finish. Suppose you never had any saltiness in the first place. Suppose you're not a Christian. You're not one of Jesus' followers, but you're looking on from the outside and saying, what am I missing? Is there something I get if I were a Christian that I'm not getting now? Well, let's just look at those three things we've talked about. A life that brings no results. There are loads and loads of people in this world who just really don't know what they're here for, don't know what they're achieving. Go round and round. I don't know if you recognize this picture, but if you do, you're likely to be as old as me. That's Joni Mitchell, one of the greatest songwriters of the 1960s, which I remember very clearly. I can't remember what I did yesterday. And Joni Mitchell wrote some great songs. She's a very honest girl. By the time she wrote this one, she was still 21. She'd already had a baby that wasn't expected, given it up for adoption. She was on the road as a singer. She was living a hand-to-mouth life. She'd seen the rough side of life. And she wrote a song where the chorus goes like this. And it's about human life. And the seasons, they go round and round. And the painted ponies go up and down. We are captive on the carousel of time. We can't return. We can only look behind from where we came and go round and round and round in the circle game. And the circle game was a massive hit because it just spoke to people where they were. We're on a roundabout going round and round. We're not going anywhere in a straight line. We're just doing the same things again and again. We're captive on the carousel of time. We can't go back. We can only look forwards. What do? A life that achieves no results. And when Jesus Christ comes into your life, suddenly there is a purpose. Suddenly there's a connection. There's a sense that what you're doing is not just going to fade away and be frittered away tomorrow. It's got a real power behind it, a life that produces results. Then the second phrase was a life that finds no rest, no place where you belong, just fit to be thrown out, says Jesus. You may still be sitting there on the shelf, but you don't really feel like you know what's happening or what it's all about. And one of the big phrases of the last few years has been FOMO, F-O-M-O. Fear of missing out. And the more YouTube videos go viral, the more social media channels there are to spend your time looking at instead of watching when you're walking across the road, the more stuff you get in your email inbox, the more you're conscious there's loads and loads of stuff going on around you and you're deluged with information and all your friends seem to be having a great time and you're missing out. And so this one said, it's cool, I'll just sit here nursing my FOMO. And there's so many people who feel there's something else in life that I haven't got yet. Where's it gone? How do I find it? All of the hopes I had and the dreams, I'm on the carousel of time going round and round, and I'm scared I'm missing out on the big thing, on what it's really all about. A bit like John in the Garfield cartoons. And it's interesting, no speech bubbles in number two and number three, because nothing changes except what Garfield's doing in the background, obviously. But it can be like that, can't it? What's my life about? Where am I going? What does it all mean? Rose has been telling us how she discovered, as she had to read halfway through the Old Testament, she had to talk to people, she had to go to meetings, all sorts of stuff, but eventually she got it all together. And through Jesus Christ, I believe you can. And there's a third thing, a life that wins no respect, that feels as if it's insignificant, just another face in the crowd, not really going anywhere or achieving anything very much. William Barclay, the commentator whose words I just read a minute ago, once said something that has resounded with lots and lots of people. It's the one quote of Barclay's you'll find on the internet over and over again. What he said was this: there are two great days in a person's life, the day we are born and the day we discover why. And Barclay, as a Christian, believed that the day you discover what you are here for is when you turn round and you look your Maker full in the face. And you realize that he loves you. He doesn't want you to be fit for nothing and thrown out and trampled underfoot. He wants you to have a life with a meaning and a purpose you'd never have otherwise. And he wants that so badly that he sent his own son to earth to live here as a human being and more, to die unjustly on a cross in terrible agony so that you could be forgiven, so that all the things you've done wrong could be sorted out and you could have a whole new life through him. And God wants you to know that. If what I'm saying is untrue this morning, it's the biggest load of rubbish you ever heard in your life. If, on the other hand, what I'm saying is true, it's something I reckon you really ought to explore. So let me suggest a couple of things you can do. One is very simple. On the way out, just take one of those Gospels that Derek and Rose were talking about and see if the book will speak to you as it spoke to Rose. You can read one of the Gospels in the New Testament in about 1 hour, 20 minutes if you're an average speed reader, so it won't take an awful chunk out of your life, and you might just discover something very important. If you think, well, it's a Bible and it might be a bit difficult, take one of these as well. This is a little booklet called Why Jesus? And it's about why Jesus makes the difference. It's simple to read. It's all written in ordinary language. It's even got cartoons. You can even colour them in if you want. I don't mind. But Why Jesus is a great introduction to what the whole thing's about. Or you could do something else. Very soon now, on the 7th of February, a Tuesday night, we're starting our Christianity course again. And this time it's Christianity the Story, looking at the whole story of the Bible and how it fits together. What's God been playing at down through human history? Why the Jews? What were all the prophets all about? Where does Jesus fit in? Why did he appear then at that particular point? And why did he make such a difference in the world? The whole thing just exploded. He died with about 120 followers. Later on, there were millions of them within the next few hundred years. What was going on? What was the source of the power of the whole thing? We're going to look at the whole thing over 8 weeks, and we can promise you 8 Tuesday evenings on which various things will happen. The first things, we have supper together, and it's usually a pretty good supper. We've got some great people cooking for us from 7 o'clock. There'll be a no-holds-barred discussion. No question is off-limits. You will never hear any of us saying, but that's stupid. Don't you know anything? No. Everything you ask is great, because if it's a question you want to have answered, that's much more important than us preaching you a sermon. Video trigger clips to start off each phase of the discussion, course notebook, magazines, it's all free, as a Scotsman that rejoices my soul, free books and other resources, all kinds of stuff, and the three guarantees we always give: no boredom, you will not be bored for a second, no pressure, you will not be forced into, you know, signing any statement or joining any club or donating your money to Belmont. You can give it to the John Allen Retirement Fund instead if you like, but that's okay. And third, no embarrassment. We are not going to embarrass you. We're not going to stare lovingly in your eyes and say, would you like to accept Jesus right now? Let's join hands and sing a song. Never happen. Never happen. You will find it's a very normal thing and you'll love it. I can say that because I know so many people have been through it, have come in terror and have gone, I was saying, that was great. So there's a way of exploring your questions as well if you've got some time to give. Can't make 8 weeks, that's okay. Come to what you can and be part of the group, and you'll profit from the whole thing anyway. Let me just finish with this woman. This is Jordan Gandhi, unusual name, but she's married an Indian guy. And she is one of the brightest people I've ever read. She's a wonderful writer, fantastically literate. She also grew up as an atheist until she went to Harvard University. And there, of course, she got a first-class degree in philosophy. She's that bright. And she says that in her first year at university, she started to look at Christianity and say, it's all a load of rubbish. But she started reading the Bible anyway, just like Rose. And she says this: at the same time, I'd begun to read through the Bible and was confronted by my sin. The fact that I wasn't as good as I thought I was. I was painfully arrogant and prone to fits of rage. I was unforgiving and unwaveringly selfish. I passed sexual boundaries that I'd promised I wouldn't. The fact that I had failed to adhere to my own ethical standards filled me with deep regret. Yet I could do nothing to right the wrongs. The cross now looked not merely like a symbol of love, but like the answer to an incurable need. And it took her months of struggling and fighting and arguing, but in the end, she made the choice. Oh, she also got married, but that's another story. And she says, now, this walk has proved to be quite a journey. I've struggled with depression. I would yell, scream, cry at this God whom I'd begun to love but didn't always like. But never once did I have to sacrifice my intellect for my faith, and he blessed me most keenly through my doubt. God revealed himself through scripture, prayer, friendships, and the Christian tradition whenever I pursued him faithfully. I cannot say for certain where the journey ends, but I have committed to follow the way of Christ wherever it may lead. When confronted with the overwhelming body of evidence I encountered, when facing down the living God, it was the only rational course of action. I came to Harvard seeking veritas. That's the motto of Harvard, and it simply means truth. I came to Harvard seeking the truth. Instead, he found me. And that can happen to you this morning. If you're already a Christian, we invite you to take part in the almost the last thing we're going to do in this service. We're going to remember the death and the resurrection of Jesus, that act that made everything different, that made it possible for ordinary human beings, failing human beings, to be the salt of the earth. And Rob is going to come and lead us in that. If you're not a Christian, that's fine. Just let the bread and the wine pass by you. No problem whatsoever. Or you could do what this woman, Jordan Gandhi, did. The way that she finally decided to take the step to become a Christian was she went to a communion service. She took the bread, she took the wine, and said, now, this is my way of saying I belong. So if you really want to find Jesus Christ for yourself this morning, take the bread, take the wine, then afterwards find a Christian, me if you're desperate, and then just see how we can help you know the reality of what you've just done for yourself.